ILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
And today on Keeping the Faith, we go from the jazz stylings that usually open this show of John Ellis, of New York, to a pianist, Dr. Susan Teicher from Eastern Illinois University, a concert pianist. Welcome, Susan.
Thanks, Steve.
Good to have you on the show today. Now, I know before you've been on Live and Local with Kevin Kelly, but it's good to have you on Keeping the Faith.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Today we're going to be talking about how music affects the spirit, among other things, but let's find out a little bit about your background. Tell us, when did you first start playing the piano?
I first started playing the piano formally, as in taking lessons, when I was 6. I had played violin for a year because my mother is a professional violinist, and she decided I should start violin when I was 5. So about that, I didn't have a choice. And after a year, she thought, well, maybe you should take piano too. My father is a professional pianist. And so I was 6. I remember my first lesson very well.
Father, a professional pianist. Mother, a professional violinist. Where did you grow up?
I grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I was born and raised in New York and grew up in this house where, you know, my parents were musicians, so I thought that was normal. I thought it was both normal growing up in New York and having parents who were musicians. So that was not exactly normal.
Now, what are your parents' names?
My mother's name is Elaine Sutton. She is still very much with us. She's still playing the violin. My mother is, not that she'd want me to say this, but she's close to 90, and she's still playing in an orchestra and in a chamber group. My father died 4 years ago. His name was Louis Teicher. He was a member of a very successful two-piano team, Ferranti and Teicher. Those are my parents.
I heard your father play.
Many people did.
Many people have.
Yes.
Sure.
Yeah.
Did you travel with your parents when they would go to do concerts elsewhere?
Not when I was little. When I was in college, when I was a freshman at Oberlin College, my father was performing in a lot of places around there, and he came by 1 week, and he kind of gathered me up, and I went with him to a few places. One of them was a place that was featured on the front of the New York Times today, Elyria, Ohio, as being a hotbed of political activity these days. But anyway, I went with him then and a couple times, but typically not. He would go off and we wouldn't go with him.
Well, since you brought up politics, let's talk about... No.
I'm teasing. Let's not go there.
people have heard enough.
Yes. Yeah, I think so.
Where did you go to college?
Initially, I went to Oberlin College for a couple of years, thinking that I didn't want to be in New York City anymore because I'd had enough of it and I wanted to go to a real college. If I'm completely honest, I have to tell you that the Life magazine cover the year I was a senior in high school of the co-ed dorm at Oberlin College was a draw. A little bit of a draw. They have a conservatory within the college.
Sure.
And so I went there for a couple of years, and then I realized I needed to go back to New York, so I wound up at Juilliard.
You say that as if that's just sort of a normal thing to have happen. Not all children of professional musicians end up at Juilliard.
Well, both of my parents had been there. My mother came from Cleveland to attend graduate school at Juilliard, and that's where she met my dad, who had essentially grown up there. So for me, it was kind of, I guess, the backup school, because that's what I'd heard about.
Sure. But one does have to audition. Even if you're a legacy, right?
Yes. No, I don't think I got in as a legacy because you just have to go into a room and play for a bunch of people who teach there. Sure. And they don't actually care who you are very much.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, I did have to audition. And then after I got a bachelor's and master's from Juilliard, I wound up getting a doctoral degree from Peabody, the Peabody Conservatory, which is in Baltimore. And I studied with Leon Fleischer there, which was a great thing.
And our next guest next week went to Peabody, Michael Hammer, who's going to be our guest. We're doing a short series of two on the spirit of music with two pianists. So we're having fun this this October.
Nice.
What was it like actually studying at Juilliard as a young pianist?
Well, it was, I sometimes think of Juilliard as a place where you go to learn a skill. I don't know if my experience is typical because I grew up in a musical household.
Yeah.
So the music part of it wasn't the hard part. It was like buckling down to actually believing that I actually had to practice like everybody else. I have to credit my teacher at Oberlin, actually, for saying to me one day after knowing me for a little while and realizing I was not exactly practicing enough, he said, you know, Susan, you're going to have to start practicing hard. Like, why aren't you doing that now? And I said, I'm afraid if I start to practice that way that I'll lose my connection with music. And to his credit, he didn't laugh. He didn't, you know, tell me I was behaving sort of like an arrogant adolescent. He said, I understand that, Susan, but if you don't practice, you're never going to become a professional pianist, so you have to decide. And I feel like when I went to Juilliard, that was, in effect, my decision to say, okay, I'll practice like everybody else. I'll put in my 4 or 5 hours a day. I'll learn how to play trills, and I'll learn how to, you know, improve my octaves and stuff like that. But in that sense, I guess to get back to your question, it seems sort of to me as though Juilliard was sort of a technical school, almost a vocational school.
Sure.
Where you learned a skill. You learned how to do that thing. And I remember probably my last year at Juilliard, again, saying to my teacher, I was playing a late Beethoven sonata, you know, and I wanted to talk about the music. And he kept saying, well, you know, it's not very clear what fingering you're taking there. And I said to him, can we talk about the music? And he said, Susan, I'm not here to teach you to be a great musician. I'm here to teach you how to play the piano. If you're a musician, you'll be a musician. I can't actually give that to anybody.
Huh.
And that's what I felt like Juilliard was. I mean, it's in the middle of New York, and it's really competitive. People pretty much want to do this one thing.
And do you get a liberal arts education there as well, or is it really purely a technical school?
If you're getting a bachelor's degree, you have to take academic classes. My memory of those classes is that no one cared about them, that essentially people were doing it because they had to.
Because you were so focused.
Most people were.
Sure.
By the time I got to Juilliard, they were at Lincoln Center, and it was no longer the Juilliard School of Music. It was the Juilliard School, so there was drama and dance.
Right.
So my academic classes had drama and dance students, so that was an interesting mix.
I'll bet it was.
Yeah.
Now, you got a master's there in piano performance after the bachelor's.
Yes.
And then what did you study? What was your PhD in at Peabody?
Also piano. It was, you know, pretty much all about playing the piano.
Okay. So that would be a Doctor of Musical Arts?
It is. That's what it's called.
DMA.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's what it is.
So it's not a research degree like a PhD would be in music.
No.
Performance.
No. It is performance. So, yeah, the requirements are essentially performance, although I did have to write a dissertation, and there were other academic requirements. There were language requirements. You know, in order to fit a performing discipline into an academic setting, you have to kind of figure out how they match. The truth is they don't match very well, in my opinion, but it has come to be the case that most people who study music at a tertiary level wind up with these academic degrees.
Sure. We're talking on Keeping the Faith today about music and how music affects the spirit with Susan Teicher. She is a professor at Eastern Illinois University in their Department of Music, teaching piano. We'll talk about what that's like in a little bit. Let me give the phone number so listeners can join this conversation. We're always eager to have people ask their own questions and make comments. If you'd like to do that, give us a call. This program is broadcast from the Campbell Hall here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. If you're in this area code 217, punch in 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're outside the 217 area code, you may have a toll-free call, 1-800-222-9455. We're happy to have people who are listening even on the Internet. Anywhere in the continental U.S., you can punch in that 800 number, 222-WILL. That will put you in touch with our technical director, Kyle Kroa, and she will get you in line to talk with our guest today, Susan Teicher. Her name is spelled T-E-I-C-H-E-R. Some people might mispronounce it as Teicher, but it is Teicher.
Yes.
Susan, when you were at Peabody, how many folks were there? Is that a big school? I don't know much about it.
I'm not sure what the student population at Peabody is. They've been officially a part of Johns Hopkins University for some years now. I would guess that there are a few hundred students at Peabody.
Uh-huh. And did you become a Orioles fan while you were in Baltimore?
No, but I am a fan of The Wire.
Okay. All right. What's it like to get a DMA in piano performance? Here you'd been studying since you were six, seven. You'd been to Juilliard already. That was, a 5 or 6 year program. And now how Yes. long did you spend at Peabody?
I lived in Baltimore for 2 years. It was 2 years of full-time Okay. study, and then it took me a couple more years to actually get the thing finished.
To write the dissertation.
Yes, yeah. Yes. That was the hard part, actually. Okay. But I can tell you, I can say that in a way I feel like I was really fortunate to finish my studies at Peabody. I really loved Peabody, and I loved Baltimore. And I especially loved my teacher there, Leon Fleischer. He was really an inspiration and a great teacher. And in a certain way, I felt like I had come full circle because you asked me about my first piano lesson.
Sure.
And what I remember about my first piano lesson, which was my teacher at the time was a friend of my mom's, who was herself a great player. And because I had studied violin for a year, she wasn't giving me beginning stuff. She was sort of expecting me to play real music, and all I had to do was learn one more clef.
At age six.
Yeah, but you have to remember that I grew up in this house where this is what people did. I can segue here. I won't finish the story, but I'll tell you a joke, okay? It's not actually a joke. It's a story, but it's a true story. My parents are both Jewish, secular, definitely. And when I was a kid, someone asked me if my parents were practicing Jews. And I thought for a moment and I said, yeah, because they were practicing all the time. And I thought, that's really weird that they're asking me whether they're practicing Jews. That's such a strange thing to ask. And it was only later that I discovered what that meant.
Yes.
So I had actually given the wrong answer. But what I was going to say about my first piano lesson is that she gave me this very, very simple piece, actually by Béla Bartók, of all people. He wrote a lot of pieces for beginning piano
Yes.
students. And I remember playing it the day after she gave me the lesson and having this amazing sense of connection with everything. Never felt that way when I played the violin, but there was something that happened, and I thought, oh, that's what it is. It's like I can do anything I want here. I can connect with everything I feel, everything I observe, everything that's out there. It's all right here. I like got it. It was this amazing thing that I had never experienced with any other activity. And I feel like when I was a doctoral student with Leon, that happened again. It's like I had finally actually learned to play the piano. I had practiced hard.
Sure.
I'd been in this
place. The technique
place.
Was automatic by
technique
this point.
The technique was there. Yeah. I'd been with all these people who, like, all they want to do is play piano, you know.
Sure.
It's like at Juilliard, like, you basically live in a practice room.
Yeah.
And when you come out, there are these people who want to talk about these pieces they're practicing.
Yeah.
And then I felt like what we were talking about was the music. And he was saying, well, what do you want to do with this phrase, Susan? And I was not being, I wasn't accustomed to being asked that. And it was like, wow. So my time at Peabody was very important to me.
Now tell me and listeners what it means when Leon Fleischer said to you, what do you want to do with this musical phrase? What was he asking?
And well, that's a really good question. And when he asked me, I was flummoxed. My whole time at Juilliard, nobody had ever asked me that. And I remember turning to him and saying, what do you mean? And he just sort of looked out over the top of his trifocals and said, what do you want to do with this phrase, Susan? What do you want to do with it? It's 8 bars. Tell me what you want. And I couldn't answer. I thought, well, it kind of goes like this. And he wanted me to decide what I wanted. And then he wanted me to figure out how I was going to do it. And he said, the hard part is deciding what you want.
Oh.
And it gave me a framework for thinking about making music that I had relied on my intuition. I'd relied on, you know, this sort of thing called musicality that you're
sure.
sort of born with.
Well, if you grow up in a musical family, perhaps.
Yes, that's yeah. right. That's right. So it's not an easy thing to explain because...
Well, let's go to some music.
All right.
I happen to have arranged to have a little bit of piano music, and so let's listen to this, and then we'll
okay.
talk about phrasing and what that might mean.
Okay.
Tell us what we're going to hear,
since
this is you play.
Well, I think what we're going to hear is a movement from a suite by Claude Debussy. It's called Images, or Images. He wrote 2 books. This is book 1, and this is the 3rd piece from that set. And it's just called Mouvement. In English, that would just be movement. And that's what it is. It's just, that's all he called it.
Let's hear this piano music. Thank you. We've just heard Movement from Images by Claude Debussy, played by Dr. Susan Teicher, concert pianist and professor of music at Eastern Illinois University. Susan, let's talk about that piece. How exciting it is.
Yeah, it's a great, great piece. And all three of the parts of that, and from book two to, they're all beautiful. Claude Debussy was one of the greatest composers of the 20th century. It's interesting, he only lived 18, well, let's see if I'm remembering that right. He didn't live long into the 20th century, but he is definitely one of the great composers of that period. And a lot of his piano music has descriptive titles, you know, about water or about fish or, you know, colors. And this one, I sort of like the title of this because it just means motion or movement.
Sure.
And it's something that the sense of motion, rhythm in general, is something I certainly talk a lot about with my students. And I always say, so what is music? What is it? And, you know, we wind up deciding it's some kind of sound and some kind of rhythm, right? It, sort of broadly speaking, it's got to have some of both of those elements. Although there are people who might disagree with that. Maybe John Cage would disagree with that. I don't know. But I would say that. And I have definitely decided as I get older that if I had to choose one or the other, I'd pick rhythm, that you can have music that's just rhythm. And that, you know, the way music exists in time is really critical.
Where was this recorded?
This was a performance I gave a lot of years ago, actually, at Carnegie Recital Hall in New York. Oh. It was a recital I gave there.
Oh. And how did you pick Debussy?
Well, that's an interesting question. When I got to Peabody, actually, to study with Leon Fleischer, I decided I would only study pieces that I would have never played before, either because I wouldn't have really been that interested in the composer, or I would have felt like it was too hard, or it would be music maybe that wouldn't come as naturally to me. French music was something I hadn't played a lot of. Piano students are sort of steeped in a sort of German tradition. You know, they play Bach and Mozart and Haydn and Beethoven and Schumann and Brahms, and, you know, that's sort of our, you know, the basic food group kind of. And that's partly because French music is really hard technically. It's also because French music is really different than German music. So that was a piece I decided to study with him at Peabody. I had always really loved the piece, and I thought, well, I'm going to try to play this thing.
And Chopin?
Chopin is sort of on the cusp, I would say. You know, at the point I started thinking about French piano music, for a while I sort of divided all music into either French or German, which I know sounds a little peculiar, but Chopin would definitely fall on the French side of it in a certain way. Of course, he lived in Paris for most of his life. French music is very sensual. You know, it's all about what you see and hear and feel and smell and, you know, and all that stuff. So the approach to the keyboard has to be really sensitive to sound in a way that is not as critical if you're playing Beethoven, for example, who I love. But you can be a great Beethoven player and not actually have that great a command of the sound, although it helps. But you can't be a great player of French music and not deal with the sound, the actual sound itself.
And when you talk about the sound, that gets us back to the whole notion of phrasing that kind of led us into this example. How is phrasing different with Debussy, Chopin, as opposed to Beethoven and Bach?
I'm not sure I would say phrasing is different. I mean, a phrase is a phrase. You know, it's like a sentence. I mean, it's a bunch of notes that go together and make some kind of sense.
And some sort of movement, maybe?
Yeah. I mean, I would just say that, that again, that when you play French music, that the actual sound itself, just for the sake of itself, is really important. Just how you approach the keyboard. How soft can you play? You know, what color is this chord? I remember when I first studied the first piece of this set of Debussy Image, I had to practice actually just sort of making my fingers go over the notes, but not making any sound. So sort of coming to sound from silence rather than think, well, get softer, just sort of this primordial sense of, you know, any sound at all. So I wouldn't say it's so much to do with phrasing. It's more to do with the sound.
When you play the piano and you're playing either one note at a time or several notes at a time or, you know, all these wonderful combinations that pianists can do, does a professional pianist, a concert pianist, actually have control over which notes in a chord are sounded more loudly than others within that one chord?
Yes. Huh. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I would say that's one of the basic things you have to be able to do. You have to be able to know which notes you want to bring out and then be able to do it to figure out
consistently.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And how young are you when you learn how to do that?
Oh, well, that depends how advanced you get when you're young. I'm not sure I really learned to do that until I was, I don't know, probably when I started practicing seriously in high school because I decided I wanted to audition for schools, you know, when I was a teenager.
Uh-huh.
I know there were a lot of things I didn't understand about that, and you know, until I was, I don't know, maybe 16, 17, something like that.
So here are all these notes on a score that this composer has written, and there's some dynamic markings. There may be a crescendo. There may be a, you know, how loud the composer conceived it. So where does your freedom come to phrase things and change things and slow certain notes down or speed them up? Do you have total freedom? When do people start saying, oh, she shouldn't have done that?
Well, people will always say they shouldn't have done that. I mean, you know, if you ask 20 different musicians, they'll tell you 20 different things.
Mm-hmm.
There are some performing musicians who are extremely strict about that. I would say there's a tradition of piano playing that's very strict about that. There was a pianist named Rudolf Serkin,
sure,
who was known as a Beethoven player, and he was extremely strict about that. You know, if Beethoven wrote a certain fingering, or if he had a certain dynamic, or if he had a certain tempo marking, that the goal of the performer was to be as loyal as possible to what it actually literally said. I think there are other schools of piano playing where there is a lot more freedom, you know, that you can take more time, you can slow down or speed up or, you know, do other things. I think it usually comes down to a personal preference. You know, there are people, for example, who are early music experts, you know, play a lot of Baroque music, and they can go on for a long time about how to play a trill, what note to start on, you know. But I think at the end of the day, performing musicians do what they like because they like the way it sounds, they like the way it feels, it sort of resonates with some innate musical sense that they have.
And that connection with the broader world that you said you got at certain points in your playing.
Yeah, like something just feels right. There's something my mother used to call a critical tempo. And that when you get it, you know it. Like everything falls into place. You sort of get it a certain tempo, and all of a sudden everything kind of works. So I think, but everybody's critical tempo is going to be different, you know. So if 20 different people play the same piece, they're going to be those personal variations.
We're talking with Susan Teicher, a concert pianist, a professor of music at Eastern Illinois University. About piano playing, about music, and how it affects the human spirit. I'm Steve Shoemaker, the usual host for these Keeping the Faith programs, and next week we're going to continue this series with another pianist, also trained at Peabody. His DMA is also from there at Johns Hopkins, Dr. Michael Hammer. Michael is the organist for Faith United Methodist Church, and he also accompanies the chorale and also accompanies Central Illinois Children's Choir. So we'll be talking with him about his many experiences with music. He's also a blogger about music, and he has a great blog called pianonoise.com. I recommend it. He has a lot of thoughtful and funny things there that he says about playing the piano and music. That'll be next week, October 21st, 2012, here on Keeping the Faith. The next week, October 28, I'll be traveling out of town, and we have a guest host, Professor Danny Otto, also from Eastern, who will be interviewing Professor Anil Bera from the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign about Tagore on spirituality. Now, Rabindranath Tagore came here from India. His son studied at the University of Illinois. Tagore was a poet and a social reformer, a painter, an artist, very multi-talented. He spent some time in Champaign-Urbana around 1906, 1910, somewhere in there. And some of his first poems were translated into English and published here at the University of Illinois early on in the 20th century. So Danny Otto will be interviewing Anil Bera about the Tagore Festival, which continues here in Champaign-Urbana in memory of some of those events. Later on Keeping the Faith, Mark Johnson will be here November 4th by phone talking about books you should know. Later in November, we'll be talking about serving an interracial church with a pastor from Philadelphia. A couple announcements, musical announcements to start with. The Broke Artists of Champaign-Urbana next week will be having an instrumental concert right after this program. It starts at 7:30 at McKinley Presbyterian Church in Champaign, Illinois, featuring guest soloist Dr. Michael Tunnell, works of J.S. Bach and Telemann. That's October 21st, 7:30 at McKinley Presbyterian Church, Champaign. And on November 3rd, the chorale, I mentioned Michael Hammer is a accompanist for the chorale, directed by Judy Beiler, will be performing November 3rd at Faith United Methodist Church. That's a free concert. It's on Prospect Avenue in Champaign. A lot of choral music will be sung, and I'll, in the interest of full disclosure, I'll admit that I'm a member of that singing group, and so I invite people to that free concert. I should have mentioned that the Broke Artists of Champaign-Urbana, the Bach group, there is a $20 general admission. Students are admitted at $10. That's next week, October 21st at 7:30. The chorale concert is at 7 p.m. on November 3rd at Faith United Methodist Church. And that concert is partly a tribute to the late Dan Perino, who was very supportive of the chorale and participated in many of the concerts in different ways. At the Y this week on Friday Forum, let's see, that will be the 19th, Friday, October 19th. The topic is the fight for campaign finance reform in Illinois, a very needed topic. David Morrison, who's deputy director of the Illinois Coalition for Political Reform, will be talking at the University Y at the University of Illinois, Friday, October 19th at noon. A free lecture. You can get a lunch there as well and participate in that live discussion. Well, let's get back to our guest today. We're talking with Susan Teicher about the spirit of music. And let me give the phone numbers. I know people are often happy to listen to the question and answer that we have here in the studio, and in this case, a couple examples of some wonderful piano music. But if you have a comment or question, we're also happy to have you join in the conversation. Punch in your phone, 333-9455, if you're in the Champaign-Urbana, Illinois listening area. If it's long distance, 1-800-222-9455 is a toll-free call. And if you've missed part of this show and would like to hear other parts, or your schedule won't let you hear the whole hour at this time, this will be archived, and you can hear it at your convenience online at will.illinois.edu/keepingthefaith. And just leave the G off of keeping, and you can hear that on several devices, of course, at your convenience. That's our archive program. Well, Susan, we're talking a little bit about what it's like to make music out of these notes that composers give you. Who are some of the pianists that you have that have influenced you? You mentioned, of course, your own professor, Leon Fleischer,
yes.
Your own father.
Yes.
Your mother, who played the violin. But
yes.
Who else, what other pianists have you just so enjoyed or learned things from?
Well, maybe I can answer your question sort of in an indirect way, in
sure.
the sense that because violin was my first instrument and because my mother was a violinist, and she often, I would say almost weekly, had her friends to the house and would play quartets, string quartets.
Sure.
So I grew up not just hearing my dad practicing piano, but I heard her playing string quartets almost weekly. So again, that was just sort of the norm. You know, I'd be in my room playing and she'd be playing quartets, and I would just hear them just as background. She told me she once came into the room and I was humming something under my breath, and she was trying to figure out what I was humming, and she realized I was humming the beginning of a Beethoven string quartet, except I was sort of swinging it. I was dotting the rhythms. And she always said that she thought that was really funny. But it's a way of saying that I absorbed those as a very young child. So when I think of music that feels the closest to me, it's actually string quartets. And when I play piano, in a sense, I'm trying to sort of sound like I remember that feeling to me. The piano is basically a big machine. It can be very mechanical. The kind of skills you have to acquire to play the piano well are mechanical ones. You're pushing these black and white keys down. You know, you're learning to strike them at the right time. You don't actually have to create a sound. You just have to push a key down. You know, the sound is being created within the instrument by hammers and strings and dampers. And, you know, most piano students, if you ask them where the sound comes from or how the sound is created, have no clue. All they're doing is pushing these black and white things down. And because of that, and because of the fact that you can't sustain a sound on the piano at the moment you strike the key, it's the loudest it's ever going to be. There's nothing you can do to it after you strike it. So everything you have to do to play the piano is in preparation to play the note, which is a very strange way of approaching music.
Hmm.
Very different than, for example, vocalizing, which is probably the most basic way of making music, singing. That it's only after you've breathed and started to vocalize that it's actually happening, right? And at the moment it happens, you can change it. You can make it sharper, flatter. You can make it louder or softer. You can make it more resonant. You can increase your vibrato, lessen your vibrato. It's like, in a sense, you could argue that the music only starts to happen when it starts to happen. On the piano, it stops happening the minute you hit it. And to me,
you can hold down that pedal, but it
yes,
doesn't get louder.
That's right. It kind of gives the impression that you're sustaining it. So for me, I know it's not exactly answering your question about my favorite players of the instrument, but I listened to a lot of string music as a kid. And when I was in high school, if I listened to music, it was often string quartets. I would listen to recordings of string quartets. When I was...
Which quartets did you like?
The Beethoven string quartets.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but,
I'm sort of...
But which players?
Ah, well, my parents had this is the Budapest string quartet, which is, you know, that was sort of they were very famous at the time.
Sure.
There are a lot of quartets that I like, you know, since then. I've listened a lot to the Juilliard string quartet. There are a lot of different
Tokyo.
Quartets. Yes, I like the Tokyo string quartet. I like a lot, you know, I just like string quartets. Uh-huh. I like the way they sound.
Now, when your mother would play her violin, would she be first violin, second violin?
I think they sort of switched parts.
Around.
Some of her friends who she played with were not professional musicians.
Really?
She had a really close friend, a cellist, who was a physicist.
Wow.
She had a friend who was, you know, like they were in business. I mean, they did this because they loved it.
Sure.
And that was another reason I think it was so nice, because they were people who really wanted to do it. They were just getting together to
sure.
play this great music.
For their own pleasure.
Yeah, whereas when my father practiced, it was his job.
Of course.
And when he practiced at home, it was, you know, he'd practice his scales and his stuff and stay in shape. And, you know, it was different somehow.
Now, when your father, Louis Teicher, would play at home, would he have two pianos since he was in the duo Ferranti and Teicher?
When we lived in New York, we had one piano. Okay. So when he and Arthur Ferranti practiced, they practiced at a studio with two pianos. When we moved, we later moved to the suburbs of New Jersey, and we did have two pianos. And I have two pianos, actually. I have two of his pianos in my house now. But he typically only practiced by himself at home.
Who do you play with, duo?
Well, I've played with a few different people, and sometimes I accompany students that way. I've had students playing concerto movements or something like that. Some years ago, I played some of his arrangements for the first time, and a friend of mine, Martha Thomas, played with me for a while. I've played with my colleague, Richard Rossi, who is the choir and orchestral director at Eastern. So I've played with some different pianists.
I recently heard that the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts is going to be needing to replace one of their large 9-foot concert grands.
Yes, I heard that.
The Steinway, the Hamburg Steinway.
Yes.
It's going to cost like $200,000 to replace it.
Yes, they're amazingly expensive. Yeah.
But you inherited a couple of, I presume, fairly nice pianos.
Very nice. Not 9-foot pianos. yes, but they are nice pianos.
We're talking with Susan Teicher about music, how it affects the spirit. She's a concert pianist and the professor of music at Eastern Illinois University. Susan, when you and I were first talking about perhaps you being on this show, and I suggested the topics, the spirit of music, and you said, well, no, I'm not religious.
No, I think what I said is I don't think I'm qualified to be on your show.
But the way we define religion, spirituality, ethics, values, music is such, affects the human spirit in so many strange and difficult ways to talk about. But let's listen to another piece of music and let that lead us into our last bit of conversation. So we're going to go to track number one and tell us what this is. This is also from the same
Is this from the same set? Very different mood. It's the name of the piece is Reflections in the Water. And perhaps that's all I need to say.
Let's listen. Thank you. Reflections on the Water by Claude Debussy, played by our guest today, Dr. Susan Teicher, Carnegie Hall recital. So how did that particular lovely piece affect your spirit as you were learning it, as you performed it? And maybe there's a difference.
Well, as I said before, I hadn't played that much music, French music, before I studied that. I think I had to open myself up in a certain way to certain ways of playing I hadn't before. Another thing that strikes me now, just listening to it now, is that a lot of my dad's music was very inspired. The kind of arrangements they made were very inspired by the kind of harmonic and, I don't know, orchestral arrangements that Ravel and Debussy composed. And so as I listen to this now, I think maybe I had avoided it because it kind of reminded me of his music.
Okay.
And that in a way I had to learn how to do certain things like that. As I said before, this music is very sensual. You know, you have to sort of kind of sink into the sound of it. Even all those fast notes and all that, it's mainly just about the color, the sort of way it makes you feel. When I teach French music to a student who hasn't played it before, I always say, well, if you went to Paris, what would you want to take home as a souvenir? Like, what does it make you think of? And, you know, they say perfume and chocolate and, you know, things that you taste and smell and stuff like that.
What courses do you teach at Eastern?
I teach applied piano almost entirely. I teach a little bit of chamber music. I teach accompanying. But for the most part, it's simply piano, applied piano.
How many students do you typically have in a semester that you're dealing with?
Well,
this is mainly one-on-one, I take it.
It is one-on-one. It's very work-intensive for a university to have a music department because much of the instruction is one-on-one. Some of my students are music majors, piano majors. Some of them are music majors but not piano majors. Some of them are non-majors. Some of them are graduate students, sort of a mix of people at Eastern.
How long have you been teaching at Eastern?
I've been teaching at Eastern since 1997.
Where were you before that?
Well, I've lived in this community, Urbana-Champaign, since 1990. I've lived in Urbana since 1990, and I taught for some years at the U of I. Again, mostly that was coaching chamber music that involved piano and strings, usually. I lived in Sydney, Australia for several years before that. I taught at the conservatory in Sydney.
What do you like most about teaching?
Oh, I like it when my students practice. And I like it when they listen to me and do what I tell them. It's very gratifying to have a student who grows and who gets something. You know, it's very exciting to have a student who does something I don't expect them to do, who, you know, sort of when I'm listening to them, I go, wow, you know, they're doing something. They're moving me in some way. One of the best things anybody's ever said to me after a performance that I did when I was a student, maybe I was 20, somebody came up to me afterwards and took my hand in his and said, Susan, it's not often that I have hope for the world. Tonight you gave me hope. And I will never forget that.
Sure. And what was it about the music that gave him hope as interpreted through your playing?
Well, I'm not sure I can tell you that. I remember what I played. I played Bach and Beethoven and Chopin. And, you know, I was young enough then to still have, I was still sort of playing from the gut, you know. I think I've always been sort of, an intuitive kind of player. And that's always what it was about to me. I mean, that's, I think, why it was a challenge for me to sort of get down to brass tacks and really practice hard because I wanted it always to be this kind of, you know, experiential, emotional, spiritual thing, which it is, except in order to really do it the way you want to, you have to have the technical skills too.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have an older brother who is no longer living. I have a younger brother. I also have children who are both musicians.
Were your brothers musicians?
My brothers were both musical,
okay,
not professional musicians. My younger brother is a blues harmonica player.
Wow.
But he doesn't earn his living that way.
Yeah. It would be hard to do.
Yeah, it would be very hard to do, yes.
What about your children?
My daughter, Pamela, is a singer-songwriter. My son, Julian, is a violinist. So,
Where do they live?
They live in Minneapolis and Cleveland, respectively. It's a hard way to make a living, you know. I always tell anybody who asks, you know, if there's something else you think you want to do, do it. And you can always play music, you know. Having to make a living as a musician is a challenge.
Very difficult.
Yep, it is. Not what most parents want to tell their kids. Yeah, become a musician. That'll be great.
Right. Right.
Yeah. My mother says that when we were little and she'd be on the park bench with, you know, the other mothers and we'd all be playing in the sandbox and some people would say, so what does your husband do? And she'd say, he's a musician. And often they'd say, yeah, but what does he do for a living?
Right.
You know, because people couldn't imagine that that was actually a way to earn a living.
Hmm. Well, we've been talking today on Keeping the Faith with Susan Teicher, professor of music at Eastern Illinois University, concert pianist, about the spirit of music. Susan is a graduate of Juilliard, 2 degrees from there, and a DMA from Peabody at Johns Hopkins. Next week, we'll be continuing our discussion of music with some examples also by another Peabody doctorate, Dr. Michael Hammer, who is the organist at Faith United Methodist Church and who accompanies the chorale and is also accompanies the Central Illinois Children's Choir. In addition, he is a blogger and has a wonderful blog called pianonoise.com. Susan, I didn't ask you, do you have a blog?
I don't have a blog.
Do you tweet? Do you have Facebook fans?
No, I am a total, like... technophobe.
So you practice the piano and you teach.
Yeah, I walk, I read, you know.
Next week, Dr. Michael Hammer, that's October 21, 2012, here on Keeping the Faith. The following week, October 28, I'll be traveling, but we have a guest host, Professor Danny Otto, also from Eastern Illinois University, professor of philosophy there, head of the philosophy department, who will be sitting in this chair here on Keeping the Faith, and he'll be talking about Rabindranath Tagore on spirituality. Tagore was the first person to win a Nobel Prize in Literature who was not a European for his writing, his poetry. He also was a painter, an artist, a social reformer. His son went to the University of Illinois, and Tagore himself visited here and stayed here for a while. Given sort of sanctuary by the Unitarian Universalist Church here in Urbana-Champaign when he'd written some things very critical about the United States' entry into World War I. So it should be a very interesting discussion with Professor Anil Bera from the University of Illinois about the Tagore Festival that will be happening here in November. Those are some of the programs coming ahead on Keeping the Faith. I'm Steve Shoemaker, and thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keepin' the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
news, public affairs, local programming, classical music. WILL's AM and FM stations are a community resource worth supporting. There's still time for you to help triple the value of supporter pledges during our two-for-one donation deals during our fall pledge drive next week. Now's the time. Give online at willpledge.org. And thanks.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL.